Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the freedom to travel a fundamental American right or a privilege granted to only a certain segment of the population? And what constitutes a reasonable restriction by which U.S. citizens are allowed back into the country after they go abroad? Passports have been part of American globetrotters' lives for the better part of a century. But as my guest today will tell us, they have morphed over time from a document designed simply to authenticate U.S. citizenship in the early 20th century to one that allows for close federal monitoring and even restriction of travel in the 21st, so that in multiple instances, U.S. citizens who have left the country with a valid passport have been denied reentry later on. Jeffrey Kahn is Associate Professor of Law at SMU's Dedman School of Law. His new book is called Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and Terrorist Watch Lists. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm very glad to be here.
As it stands today, what has Supreme Court precedent determined about the freedom to travel as a fundamental American right?
You would think that would be a simple question to answer. But it turns out that a right that most Americans would just assume that they've got is nowhere found in the text of the Constitution. But as law students learn, the text is typically just the starting point. So we look to other parts of the Constitution, the way the different parts come together in terms of their structure, the history of the evolution of the text, things like that. And we also look to the case law of the Supreme Court to see how they've interpreted text and structure and history in the past. The short answer is that it depends what your itinerary is. If you're traveling within the United States, domestic travel, then the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, provides a pretty high level of protection, considering your right to travel fundamental. If you're traveling internationally, then the Constitution doesn't give as much protection. Then the court has said your right to travel abroad is really just, quote, an aspect of liberty. And therefore, it's going to be protected only by a balancing test that determines what sort of due process any infringement of your liberty might entail. But that's really just a starting point. It becomes even more difficult because the question then becomes, well, what constitutes an infringement on your right to travel? And the Justice Department in recent times has gone back to some pretty old cases to say, well, infringing your right to travel couldn't be done by just limiting access to one mode of travel. And this has been the starting point for their defense of the no-fly list.
All right, so let's step back for a moment and talk about the development of any American restrictions on citizens' rights to travel internationally and then return. How did the first passports come into existence, and how do they differ, not physically, but in terms of the rights and privileges they granted from the documents that we all have to have today?
You would think that passports were always the same because they seem to serve an essential function. A citizen wants to go somewhere, you need a passport to go. But that's really a creature of the 20th century. Back when passports were first conceived, when the word passport was first used, it actually wasn't used for citizens at all. It was used for foreigners to pass through a nation's ports, passport, and not have to get a string of visas every time from the controller of that port and all the other ports that they would be traveling through. In the 20th century, immediately after World War I, nation states began to realize that the controls they put on travel during wartime were very useful. And why not keep them during peacetime? And gradually, the passport became something not to control the movement of foreigners through your own ports, but to control the travel of your own citizens when they went outside of your ports to the ports of others.
And we decided that a function that initially was a power granted to the executive branch during wartime exclusively ought to be expanded to all the time.
Well, there's several themes in my book, and that's certainly one of them. When we go to war, when we feel a crisis of national security, our immediate fears are turned outwards. Somebody is doing this to us, some foreign source of danger. And so we begin these restrictions in that way, restricting the access of foreigners coming into the country, restricting our citizens' power to leave the country and go to foreign shores. But gradually over time, those restrictions turn inward. and begin to affect our view of internal security. And why shouldn't it? Because as you look at our history, threats don't always come from abroad. They often are homegrown.
I want to talk about the namesake of your book, Ruth Shipley, who is a fascinating character that I'll confess I'd never heard of before until I read this. From 1928 until the mid-50s, the buck stopped with her in terms of any American who wanted a passport.
It really did. FDR, who worked closely with her, described her as his wonderful ogre, and he meant that as a real compliment. She wasn't a political appointee. She wasn't a particularly highly educated woman, but she rose to a very high level of government authority, which was, in the time she was working, extremely unusual. And she rose there entirely on her own merits. She was sharp. She was dedicated. She was careful and cautious when she needed to be, especially when maneuvering the political shoals of 20th century Washington. She started out as a clerk, rose through the passport office, cutting her teeth during World War I, learning of some of these dangers, and also learning from family relations. Her brother was the first director of what later became the FBI. As she took control of the passport office, the United States was about to enter World War II, and with it a massive increase in passport fraud, which was her first big assignment, to stop passport fraud, both to make sure that only American citizens would be returning to the United States from Europe, and also to prevent saboteurs, subversives, enemies from coming into the U.S. And harming us using fraudulent passports. But her real claim to fame was in creating a system of travel controls after World War II, when our new enemy, international communism, was not merely a political enemy, but an existential threat. It was deemed to be an existential threat by Congress against the United States. And it was ideological. It was international. Its adherents were zealots, and they were backed by a Soviet power with nuclear weapons. She decided, with help from the passport, that if she could control who was going in and out with the passport by determining that your right to go abroad was just not in the interest of the United States, she could do a lot to thwart international terrorism, but international communism.
And she was not above sort of making personal judgments on who ought to travel. For example, she thought like post-war Europe was no place for a child, even if that child's parent was a high-ranking diplomat.
Right. You're referring to a wonderful anecdote in the book involving Eleanor Dulles, who was the sister of the Dulles brothers, one of whom ran the CIA and the other, John Foster Dulles, was her boss, Secretary of State. And Eleanor Dulles wanted to go to Austria to work with the U.S. Army in post-war reconstruction. She went to Mrs. Shipley, whose office was in the Winder Building, just across the street from the White House, and asked for a passport. Mrs. Shipley looked at the application. She said, "You can go, but post-war Austria is no place for children." "Well," Eleanor said, Either my children are going or I'm not going," at which point Mrs. Shipley reached across the table, snatched her passport and said, "Well, then you're not going." And it took the combined efforts of the British ambassador to the United States, the Swiss ambassador to the United States, who were trying to offer letters of transit for her access to Europe, and the Dulles brothers, both of them, before Mrs. Shipley changed her mind. And it was one of the very few recorded instances I could find where she actually did change her mind.
So we can sort of smirk at a story like that today, but now we would imagine the passport system, the processes by which passports are granted or denied, are very proceduralized, and nothing could be so capricious. But as it turns out, if one finds oneself the subject of suspicion, either correctly or incorrectly, there is a great deal of gray area regarding why or when one is denied a passport.
It's easy to caricature her, and I certainly don't mean to. And I really meant what I said when I said she was an intelligent, dedicated, and very patriotic civil servant. She really was doing her very level best to do what she thought was in the interest of the United States. The system that she created has now been regularized. There is no Mrs. Shipley who's going to control your access to a passport. And that's in large part because the Supreme Court decided, although in ways that don't really help us with the no-fly list, that the right to a passport for travel couldn't be infringed by Mrs. Shipley's methods. Passports, therefore, aren't used to control travel in the same way that they were in her day. Now it's a anonymized, highly classified, secret government watch list, the no-fly list, which is composed by many, many different analysts, each taking a small piece of it. So in a way, Mrs. Shipley's ghost, the title of my book, refers to the idea that her concept of controlling travel now has been diffused. It's a ghost in the machine of all of these different computers and analysts and databases that are spread all over Northern Virginia and the district, that will control your travel in the same way that she did, in the sense that they're using secret criteria, they don't reveal their methods or sources of information, and it's very difficult to challenge being put on the no-fly list, but they're not using the passport anymore.
One thing people may not be aware of is that the no-fly list is compiled by one agency, the Terrorist Screening Center, but then enforced, of course, by the TSA.
That's right. The Terrorist Screening Center is a component of the FBI, and their job is to act as a funnel and to act as a sieve. They act as a funnel in the sense that all of the government's information about known or suspected terrorists is supposed to be funneled into their database, one repository. This was a recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. They also act as a sieve, and that's where Mrs. Shipley's ghost comes in, because the analysts at the Terrorist Screening Center then examine the information on each one of these known or suspected terrorists and decides which government watch lists involving Customs and Border Protection, watch lists involving air travel, like the no-fly list, this person or persons should be on. And then once those sublists are composed, they are distributed to what the TSC calls its customers. The customer for the no-fly list is the Transportation Security Administration, TSA.
So the TSA stops somebody because this person's name appears on the no-fly list and they're at an airport. You can complain all you want to the TSA, but they can't take you off the list, no matter what you might present to them. And they can't even tell you why they're there, why you're there, because the TSA literally does not have access to that information.
Well, not exactly. And it's a little more subtle than that, and therefore a little more dangerous, I'd say. Imagine you want to travel somewhere. You want to travel to London. So you go online, you find your ticket at the best option, cheapest price, and you buy it. No problem buying the ticket. But you'll recall when you buy these tickets, you're now being asked for information you weren't asked before. Mm-hmm. Not just what your name is and what your credit card information is, but your date of birth, your gender, if you have what's called a redress number because you've already gone through this rabbit hole already. All this information will be asked at the point of sale. You buy the ticket. You think you're buying the ticket. What you're really buying is a reservation. At some point between when you buy it and when you want to travel, usually within 72 hours of travel, all that information will be sent to the TSA. The TSA will look at the list that they've been given by the TSC and see if your name is on it. If it is, even though you've paid for it, you're not going to be issued a boarding pass. And that's where your troubles begin.
My guest is Jeffrey Kahn. He's associate professor of law at SMU's Dedman School of Law and author of the new book, Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and Terrorist Watch Lists. Join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with SMU Associate Professor of Law Jeffrey Kahn about his new book, Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and Terrorist Watch Lists. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jeff, what right do we have to know why we happen to appear on the no-fly list or any of the watch lists that exist in this country today?
It depends who you ask. If you ask the TSC, the Terrorist Screening Center that composes the list, well, if you could figure out who to ask at the TSC, they tell you you have no right at all. The government makes lists all the time. The government seeks out information all the time. And you don't have a right, some individual right, to know what some official in the government knows. On top of that, and more particularly, they'd say this information is classified, and if you don't have a classification that matches the level for this list, you don't have a right to it. If you ask the ACLU or you ask someone who has suffered through being on the no-fly list or one of the similar lists, they'd say, well, if you're going to use that information to do something to me, like tell me I can't go where I want to go, or I can't have a license for my job, or I can't use my license the way other licensed citizens would use it, I at least ought to know why so that I have a chance to respond. Maybe you made a mistake. Maybe the information is old. Maybe the information is true, but I've got some additional information that could put it into perspective. With passports, we already went through this conversation. Because that's exactly what Mrs. Shipley did. She'd deny you a passport, send you a very nice letter saying your travel is not in the interest of the United States. You could go and argue with her, but she would not tell you why. She would not show you her files. And this lasted for quite a while, until the very end of her reign, in fact, when the courts began to say, you know what? If you're going to use this information to deny citizens the right to travel, they ought to have a chance to rebut it. And eventually, the Supreme Court came around to that thinking, too. And that's why I think, since the same method is being employed with the no-fly list, although it might be a long time, I'm hoping that the same result will apply.
Not in the interest of the United States. So does that mean that when I travel, I am agreeing to be a good representative of the U.S. somewhere else in the world and act as a sort of de facto ambassador?
That was the argument of the State Department in the 50s under Mrs. Shipley. They said, if you are traveling, it's because we've given you a passport. And if you look in your passport, it says you're traveling under our protection. And the courts agreed with the State Department in some pretty colorful metaphors. They said the State Department can't be forced to let matches loose in the international tinderbox. The State Department can't be forced to allow someone who's going to speak out against the United States, like Paul Robeson, say, out to make the case against the United States. I object to that point of view. I think it's a bad premise, because the premise is that you are a representative, a proxy of the United States. If you shifted the right we were talking about from travel to speech, nobody would say, well, when you go abroad and you say, I don't like Guantanamo Bay, or I don't think we should be at war with Iraq, that you are in some way violating your relationship, your contract with your government. No, you've got a freedom to say whatever you like. Why? Among other reasons, because your speech isn't taken to be a proxy for government policy, and nor should it. That's the way subjects of a monarchy are treated. That's the way the citizens, for lack of a better word, of an autocracy or a dictatorship are treated. They're not let out of their countries for fear that they may speak badly of the king or of the dictator. I don't think that's the relationship a citizen has to the government in a democratic republic like ours.
So there's the concern about not being allowed to leave the United States when we might choose to. On the other side, there is the concern of having been allowed to freely leave the United States and then being denied reentry in the absence of any documentable crime. And there have been real cases of this happening to American-born citizens and naturalized American citizens.
That's right. You might call it two sides of the same coin. What good is your right to leave if on the way out you're wondering, am I going to be allowed back in? The United States government, in its affidavits and briefs and arguments in court, has unreservedly said that U.S. citizens have a right to come into the United States. But, they've also said, you don't have the right to come by any means you choose. like an airplane. And so there have been several cases, and a number of them are pending now, in which individuals have made two allegations, broadly speaking. One is, I went out, I did my business, I tried to come back, and that's when I found that I suspected, at least, I was on the no-fly list because they wouldn't issue me a boarding pass and they wouldn't tell me why. And the second allegation is, as I was trying to unravel this at the embassy, I'm approached by an FBI agent. And the allegations continue. The FBI agent says, I can make this problem go away, but we'd really like you to talk to us about your activities, the activities of your friends, activities of people in your church or mosque or synagogue, and would you mind taking this polygraph test? Now, put yourself in those individual shoes. You're thousands of miles away. You certainly didn't travel with your lawyer. You really want to get home. What do you do? You went to the embassy because you thought, well, I'm traveling on a U.S. passport. Aren't those the guys who are supposed to help me? And now you're being told there's a quid pro quo here, a quid pro quo that the FBI could never extract if you were within the United States. If you turn down their help or you call a lawyer, you'll be told, good luck getting home. Sometimes it's taken weeks or months for individuals on this list to get home. And when they do get home, several of them have filed lawsuits.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Cheryl in Dallas. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a brief, interesting little story about passports. Back when Reagan bombed Libya, I went and spent the summer in Morocco. My ex-husband was Moroccan, and my baby daughter and I flew to Morocco that summer, the summer of 1986. And my family was really, really scared for me, you know, going by myself with a baby. But I wasn't particularly scared. But we did have a Moroccan passport for my baby daughter, and she had an American passport, okay? So what we did was when we were flying to North Africa, to Morocco, we used her Moroccan passport. And when we were flying back from Morocco, we used her American passport. We were just, you know, trying to be cautious. But it was sure interesting to have two passports for a baby. And that's all I have to say, and I'll go off the air now. And I love the subject of your talk today. Have a lovely day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, for that anecdote. Of course, if you had been traveling not in 1986 but in 1946, Mrs. Shipley, I think, would have deemed your travel not in the interests of the United States. If you'd been traveling in the early 60s, you might have met the fate of Louis Zemel. Louis Zemel wanted to travel to Cuba shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he just wanted to see what was going on. And he was denied the right to travel. And in that case, the argument was this person really could upset the international balance at a time when we thought we were just seconds away on the clock of the Bolton of the atomic scientists from nuclear Armageddon. If you were to try to travel today, it wouldn't be the passport that might restrict you. It would be the no-fly list. And the reason for saying that is a case that's been filed in the United States District Court for the District of Oregon by someone named Tarhuni, who didn't travel to Libya in your context, but in ours at the time of the revolution going on in Libya. And he found that when he tried to return home, he was unable to do so. And he alleges, and these are just allegations in his complaint, that when he went to the embassy for help, the old story occurred. An FBI agent coming to him saying, we'd like some information, we'd like to know more about you, and we'd like you to take this polygraph test. That was filed in January, so it's very early days in the state of things for this case, but it certainly is one to watch.
And so Tarhuni would have been free to refuse to take the test or to refuse to cooperate with the FBI, but he would also have been free not to have a return passport.
Well, not a return passport, but a boarding pass.
A boarding pass.
And certainly he did refuse, because one of the things he alleges in his complaint is that he was asked to sign a waiver of various rights when he took the polygraph. The problem then is that how do you get home? And it took, in that case, if I remember the allegations in the complaint, correctly, that his attorney then contacted either a senator or a congressman from Oregon to put pressure on TSA to allow him to come back home. And in some cases, that's worked. In other cases, an important case also in Oregon called Latif, the plaintiffs there, some of them took boats, some of them tried to cross at land crossings, some of them were successful and some of them were not.
Is that a defense of this system? People say, well, we're not telling you you can't come back. We're just saying you can't come back on a plane. And yes, it's inconvenient. Yes, it might be more expensive, but you're not fundamentally being denied reentry into the country.
I don't think it's a good defense. Let's analogize again to freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Imagine if the government told you, well, of course you've got the freedom to speak and communicate any way you want, except via email. Now, we're not infringing your freedom of speech. You could still use, for instance, parchment and quill. But you're not allowed to use email. Why, you ask? Well, we can't tell you. It's classified. How do I appeal? Well, it's a rather circuitous route. And I don't think any of us would say that that wasn't an infringement on our freedom of speech. To say today, a day, an era when flying on a plane for millions and millions of Americans is not an everyday occurrence, but a pretty routine one, one that's essential for business, one that's essential for keeping in touch with family, both domestically and internationally. If we say we're in a globalized world, to say that infringing your access to planes is not infringing your right to travel seems to me a pretty strange division.
So I know that you're not arguing here that no one who might appear on the no-fly list could be considered a viable or credible threat to the United States. But we also know that mistakes have been made, that maybe there are two Chris Boyds or two Jeff Kahns with the same birth date and things get confused. So by what criteria could we amend the practices? And we'll talk about the constitutional basis for the right to travel in a minute. But could we amend the practices of putting people on the no-fly list so that it would be more fair to people who end up there?
The description I gave a moment ago of putting your gender and date of birth as well as your full name into your purchase of a ticket is part of that reform process. Just after 9/11, there were a lot of these so-called false positives, people whose names were the same or similar and finding themselves unable to travel, even though it seemed quite clear because maybe they were very old or very young that they just really weren't the same person. This happened to Senator Kennedy, who experienced what was called the Ted Kennedy problem because it appeared that there was a T. Kennedy on these lists. And in the spring of 2004, he spent several weeks trying to get off the no-fly list at a time when there wasn't this additional information requirement, which is called the Secure Flight Program. He finally had to call up his friend Tom Ridge, who had been the governor of Pennsylvania and was now the Secretary of Homeland Security. Many of your listeners may remember what happened to Cat Stevens of Moonshadow fame later that fall. So Secure Flight, this program that now requires you to give this additional information up front, is supposed to decrease substantially the false positive problem. And it has. From that perspective, it's a very successful program. But from the perspective of whether you think that you should have to ask the government's permission to travel, hasn't changed a thing.
Okay, so let's go back to, you alluded to this earlier, we have for a very long time rather aggressively defended our right to travel freely from state to state. It's no big deal if I want to drive into Oklahoma, there's no border guards, I don't have to present identification, I just go. Constitutionally, what is the justification for that freedom?
Well, if we did have that system, which, and I wear another hat as a Russian law and politics scholar, you just described the Soviet Union, an era and a place of internal passports and permission to reside in one part of the country or another. We don't have that system, but it's very hard to say exactly why. The Supreme Court has issued a number of opinions to prevent that from happening, and they've each been based on a different part of the Constitution. For instance, when states have tried to set up taxes when you cross the border, the Supreme Court has said, well, that violates, for instance, the Interstate Commerce Clause because that would infringe on Congress's power to regulate trade between the states. That infringes on the structure of our federal system because we are not supposed to be a collection of sovereign entities that are all bound together. We are supposed to be a giant free market. That's the dynamo that the Constitution succeeded in creating. More technical arguments have been made under Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, to say that since you are a citizen of the United States, when you travel from one state to another, you should be accorded all the privileges and immunities of residents of those various states. Those are all found in different opinions, but there isn't one omnibus opinion that will give you a singular constitutional source for the protection of the right to interstate travel.
Why is the right to international travel, if it is implied by the Constitution, not spelled out somewhere, or in the Bill of Rights, for instance?
Well, there are a variety of different theories. One theory is, if you remember your American history, there wasn't initially planned to be a Bill of Rights to the Constitution.
Of course.
It was added shortly after as a way of encouraging the adoption of the Constitution from those who feared a too powerful federal government. Those who defended the federal Constitution said, well, since the federal Constitution doesn't provide any power of the Congress or the executive to restrict your right to travel, it would be silly to try to put in some additional protection for the right to travel. It's not needed. It's superfluous because the power to restrict hasn't been granted. The protection of it isn't needed. And so that's one reason. Another reason might be that at the time that the Constitution was adopted, we weren't living in a globalized age. People took for granted that, well, if you don't like where you are, you just move on. You have a protection of your life, liberty, and property without due process of law. And that triad was because life, liberty, freedom of movement, and property was really all you needed to be a free citizen. That changes with changes in technology.
We are speaking this hour with Jeffrey Kahn, Associate Professor of Law at SMU's Dedman School of Law. His new book is called Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and Terrorist Watch Lists. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey Kahn. He teaches law at SMU's Dedman School of Law and is the author of Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and Terrorist Watch Lists. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Jeff, your sense is that the right to travel is guaranteed to us by the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment.
That's right. And I should preface this by saying I might be the only person in the country so far on record as believing that. Certainly the Supreme Court hasn't adopted my view, although they have come close to the premise for my view. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution has a long history and an important history. But the very first sentence says, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Now, there's a history to that, but it's the only part of the Constitution that defines U.S. citizenship. But it defines it in terms of birth and naturalization and then defines state citizenship in relation to that. It doesn't tell you what United States citizenship actually means. I argue that whatever else it means, it has to mean that you're not the subject of the United States. You're not a subject like the subject of a monarchy. You're a citizen of a republic. And our history as a country, the history of citizenship suggests that a core component of that is a right to come and go as you please. You don't owe any duties to the state by virtue of your citizenship that would require you to seek permission of the state to go out or to come back in or to move around inside. Those places that do have those restrictions don't look anything like our country. It's a Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or it's some kingdom from the Middle Ages.
And if we are left outside the United States because we are on the no-fly list or can't be issued a boarding pass, we're effectively rendered stateless, at least temporarily.
Well, there's certainly a danger of that, because if you are in some country in which you require, in any country other than the United States, if this is your only citizenship, you need the permission of that state to be there. And if that state says it doesn't wish you to be there anymore, and your own state says it's not going to be very easy for you to get back, you do have a very, very serious problem. The United States government would say the solution to that problem is take a boat. The only problem with that is that there's also a maritime watch list, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. Gosh, this is such an interesting subject. I find it so shocking that an American citizen can be put on a list and deprived of liberty without any due process of law whatsoever first, and then largely not even have any recourse. I wonder, Professor Kahn, if you have also looked into other government lists that essentially do this sort of thing, such as the child abuser list, and also the money launderer list, either one of which could keep you from working in major career fields and even keep you from buying a car or opening a bank account, that sort of thing. Again, with no due process of law whatsoever, and it's pretty close to impossible to get off of these lists.
Jeff?
Thank you for that question. There are a variety of these lists. Another one you might have added is the list for anybody who wants to transport hazardous materials, the HAZMAT list. I don't focus on those other lists in the book. I really just focus on the no-fly list because I consider that really to be the originator of all these others. But this question raises a really important point, and that is there's no logical stopping point that would say to you in the United States government, you don't need any more lists. Why in the world would you stop with a no-fly list? Wouldn't you like to have a no-gun list? Wouldn't you like to have a variety of no-fill-in-the-blank lists because of the same premise that undergirds the no-fly list? If someone is too dangerous to travel, too dangerous to fly, they should be stopped. Well, if someone's too dangerous to fly, maybe they're too dangerous to be able to purchase a firearm, or as the caller says, too dangerous to have a license to do some other activity. And there's no natural stopping point. Now, put yourself into the shoes of a government official, not from Mrs. Shipley's day, but from our own day, a day when you are being bombarded with threat assessments every day of real dangers to the United States. Why wouldn't you want an ever-expanding fill-in-the-blank list to help you in your work? Now, the U.S. government and the lawyers who are defending these cases would object to your statement that there's no due process whatsoever. They'd say there is a redress process. It's called the Traveler Redress Inquiry Program, TRIP, TRIP. But I've never really been clear whether that's supposed to be a noun, like going on a trip, or a verb, like trip you up. Because if you ever tried to use this system, you'll find that it's really not very helpful at all. What you're essentially getting to do is ask the government to take another look.
So we're guilty until proven innocent in some ways.
Well, if I were a government attorney here, I'd say I'm not accusing you of any crime. You're not guilty until being proven innocent. I'm just saying that we've made a determination because you're a known or suspected terrorist that you are a threat to civil aviation or national security, and therefore you can't fly on this plane.
We have an email here from Roshan who wants to know how many people are affected by these issues and how often does this sort of thing happen for justifiable and non-justifiable reasons? And it'll be hard to determine the definitions of justifiable in this case, but maybe you can address the question anyway.
Sure, sure. Well, the list has fluctuated in time, and you can imagine why. Immediately before September 11, the entity that was most akin to what the no-fly list became had 12 people on it, none of whom were U.S. citizens. immediately after 9/11, the list just blossomed. And at one point, it was up to over 70,000. Now, there are about, anywhere between 15 and 20,000 people on the no-fly list, of which reliable estimates from the government are that about 500 to 1,000 of those people are U.S. citizens, which raises another interesting problem, because in some cases we've said that the Constitution provides you rights, but your remedy might not necessarily be in court if those rights are violated. Your remedy might be the political process. We live in a democracy, and if enough people are outraged by some restriction on their rights, well, you can throw the bums out and get in a new set of politicians who can adjust the laws according to the democratic taste. But when the vast majority of people affected are not citizens, there is not really that much of a political incentive to do something about the problem. So the short answer is that the list is fluctuated, and you can track those fluctuations based on threats that have managed to get through our system of protections, threats like the Christmas Day bomber in 2009, Abdulmutallab, or Faisal Shahzad in Times Square.
Is there a protocol by which the names on the list are reviewed and re-verified, say, every quarter or every year or something like that?
Yes. If you had the director of the Terrorist Screening Center on your program, you would be told that there is a robust and substantial program of internal review. They can't tell you very much about it, but they will tell you that there is this substantial program. It's triggered when people put in their inquiries in the TRIP system. It's triggered by monitoring media. It's triggered by a randomized process. But it all boils down to the same thing. The people who are composing the list have two words for you when it comes to how do we know that you're keeping an accurate list. And those two words are trust us.
We have an email here that asks, can you address the domestic functional relevance of a no-fly list relative to warrantless real-time location data currently available to law enforcement through cell phone triangulation?
Boy, I haven't thought of that question other than to say that it certainly illustrates the way developments in technology can really adjust our perception of what our rights are and what it means to infringe or not infringe those rights. And there's no area of the Constitution where this is more robustly a question than with regard to the Fourth Amendment, which protects you from unreasonable searches and seizures. So questions of GPS monitoring of your vehicle or of your person, or in the most recent case decided by the Supreme Court earlier this week, Maryland versus King, the right of the state law enforcement official to take a DNA swab of the inside of your cheek. Is that an unreasonable search or seizure? This is a technological question that none of the founders of the Constitution or the framers of the Bill of Rights ever could have conceived of, but now we're confronted with it.
So clearly one can find oneself on one of these lists if there is, you know, evidence that you have terrorist sympathies, that you have had associations with people who are known terrorists. I've actually heard of journalist colleagues being flagged simply because they are in what are considered to be hotspots for an extended period of time. Can you talk about some of the other reasons why people might end up on these lists who are there for humanitarian purposes or just to get work done or to visit family?
I can't speak with any authority to what the criteria are because the criteria are classified. And it's very difficult to know from individual experience whether someone was on the no-fly list or someone was on what's called the selectee list, which subjects you to more and more intrusive security screening when you go to the airport. It's very hard to know exactly what the criteria are. And there are a lot of urban myths and speculation, in large part because they're classified. But the government has told us what their standards of review are. And the standard for review, whatever the criteria are, to figure whether the criteria are met, is a very low standard. It's called the reasonable suspicion standard. So to determine whether you are a known or suspected terrorist is a pretty low bar. And the criteria, for instance, many have speculated that you are seen in association with someone, you are seen nearby someone, you are seen talking with someone who is already flagged as a known or suspected terrorist, you may be flagged as a known or suspected terrorist. And that's because the standard is, does the individual making the determination have a reasonable suspicion based on articulable facts that you are a known or suspected terrorist? That's it. That's not even close to what people involved in law enforcement would know as the probable cause standard or other higher standards. A pretty low bar. Pretty low bar.
Can we say with any certainty that these lists are keeping people from committing acts of terrorism?
No, but I don't think that's really their purpose. The U.S. government conceives of its national security protections like a many-layered onion. This is a metaphor that's used. And so in order to protect us at the center of the onion, there are all these different layers, one of which is the no-fly list. Another would be air marshals who sit on planes randomly or because of a particularly known threat. Another would be locked cabin doors. Another would be the metal detector or special machines that you now see in airports. Do these prevent terrorism? I'm not quite sure that it's their purpose to dissuade people from committing acts of terrorism so much as it is to protect us and make it very, very difficult to succeed at committing an act of terrorism.
I don't know whether you're a betting man, but would you care to speculate on what the outcomes might be of the two cases that you alluded to, Tarhouni v. Holder and Latif v. Holder?
Well, certainly before this summer, I would be betting against myself to say that they really didn't have a chance. But there was a very important decision by the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, a court that sits on the West Coast, actually in the Latif case. And that court for the very first time said that the shell game that has been developed to insulate the terrorist screening center from the intrusive scrutiny of the courts is going to come to an end. The way it worked before this decision, the terrorist screening center, if sued, would say, we just make the list. We don't implement it. You've sued the wrong party. Sue the TSA. But if you went to the TSA would say, well, we implement the list, but we don't make any of the decisions about who's on it. You should go to the terrorist screening center, the TSC. And by the way, you've gone to the wrong court because the power that we have to create this no-fly list comes from an old system of security directives that was conceived in the 50s for the FAA. And at the time it was conceived, the idea wasn't that these decisions would be nearly as classified and protected by secrecy as they are now. And so we would build an administrative record, and you go to the Court of Appeals for that. So you're even in the wrong court. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, if an individual complains about being placed on the no-fly list and sues just the terrorist screening center, they've sued the right party and they've sued in the right court. So my hope is, and we'll find out later this month when oral argument in Latif occurs on summary judgment motions, that this case will be allowed to proceed.
Jeffrey Kahn's new book is called Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and Terrorist Watch Lists. Jeff, it's been a really informative hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed being here.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. You can get that podcast free at kera.org/think and send any comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.